Health Plan to order as a subcommittee since we're missing a quorum of the full committee. And go ahead and get started. The Senator Courtney is going to be excused all day today. She's in Portland. Other members, I'm not sure they're back where from. Senator Metzger supposedly on his way. So the idea of today was to begin to go over the mental health system. Senator Metzger has joined us. And Ms. Cass, are you going to present? Is that right? Hopefully there are people who are watching on their monitors and I'm scurrying down here to help. So.
Thank you, Senator. My name is Barry Cass, and since the last time I appeared before any committee of the legislature, the department has changed some, and I'm accompanied today by Margaret Johnson. Together, for a number of years, we were the administrator and deputy administrator, respectively, of the Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division. And since last summer, we have been in the position of Deputy Assistant Director and Deputy Assistant Director for Health Services of the Department of Human Services. So in the effort to consolidate and better integrate services, mental health, alcohol and drug services, OMAP and the health plan, and all of our public health services are now in a single branch of the department. And it's in that capacity that we're here today to talk in a more limited way about mental health and the integration of mental health services into the health plan. We know you have many questions, not just about the Oregon health plan components, but how they relate to the whole mental health system. But we thought we would begin today by talking about how we got mental health into the Oregon health plan and how that is functioning. Margie is prepared to do that, and then at your pleasure, we will respond to the concerns that are of interest to you. We also had a report to the legislature that was requested by the emergency board, and we're prepared as well to talk about that. Put the agenda for the.
Yes, that's fine. That's good, and I feel somewhat debilitated. I had just been told that Senator Fisher's on his way back to Roseburg because of a family emergency. He's not going to be driving. Either, so. And Senator Mesley, since you're joining here, if you have questions or directions, feel free to jump right in here.
Thank you.
And my understanding, there has been a reorganization within DHS. That seems to happen on a fairly frequent basis, and I'm generally unfamiliar with, you know, what it was before. Maybe you can just talk about what it is now, what its relationship. I'm very interested in its relationship with the counties and county mental health systems and kind of how all of that is connected. And if you want to just talk, and feel free to, I mean, to the extent that you're not going to get in trouble with somebody above you.
Well, I'm pleased to talk about those issues, Senator. I appreciate the opportunity. Actually, one of the things that does make health services within the department unique is that, in contrast to other branches of the department that work through our own field staff and employees, almost everything we do works through partnerships either with local government, local providers, or health plans, mental health organizations, and the like. So virtually, I hesitate to estimate because I don't have the graphs in front of me, but probably 90% of our budget are payments that we make under contracts with organizations like that. So we depend upon community providers and their agents to deliver the services that are mandated. The only exception to that are the two state hospitals and the public health laboratory, which are actually in the business with our own employees of delivering care or performing clinical functions. The thing I think that gives us some optimism here is that by putting these kinds of services together, we expect to get better results for the patients and for the communities we serve. And I make that distinction because today we're going to talk about health care, but a lot of what we do also is community-based. Public health services, for example, virtually the whole community is the client. When you talk about drinking water or licensing trauma systems or immunization programs, we're really looking at trying to elevate the health status of the whole community. And for me, at least, although I was had some doubts a year or two ago, I think this has turned out to be an exciting development for the department and for the state. It's too bad there's so much uncertainty about the budget, because this is a really a good move for the department.
Sure. Senator Crook.
With regard to the organization, is there still something called the health department in part of what you do, or some sort of structure left from that? What, how does that fit under your new title?
Mr. Chair, Senator Crow, the before the last session of the legislature, we were organized by divisions, and there was a health division as a part of the department. The legislature abolished the health division along with the other divisions and vested those responsibilities in the director. And the director has assigned the management of health services generally to us. And what we have done in turn is taken the centers from the old health division and created offices around environmental health, what's called disease prevention and epidemiology, family health, which is the maternal and child health program, and the public health laboratory. And those are essentially the components of the health division in their current form. And they are now working more closely with mental health, the Office of Mental Health and Addictions, and OMAP, to craft programs that work across the various structures.
I think we have a schematic, so have an organizational chart for you.
It's working well. The hardest part, Mr. Chairman, is explaining it all. But, I understand there is a report from the department that is forthcoming. So,
and I think for the purpose of legislators, at least it's been my experience that there are oftentimes agencies and people assume that we understand to the same degree you do how your organization functions or what is, or, you know, what its organizational structure is, and that's by and large not true. So most of us, at least in the political realm, have certain opinions that we, you know, form as part of who we are as politicians. But my sense is that often if we go in and dig through the organizational structure and talk about what people's functions are, what their objectives are as an entity, the objections oftentimes dissipate. And sometimes they don't, but more often than not, they do. So, yeah. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, we are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Margie Johnson, and I'm the Deputy Assistant Director for Health Services with the department. And we thought it would be helpful to go back and just do a little brief summary of the history of mental health and how mental health was included in the Oregon Health Plan. Back during the planning for the health plan, there was concern about the way that these services and the eligible population should be included in the health plan, and the decision was made that mental health would be phased in. And that began with the 25% of the Medicaid eligible population being covered in the health plan on a pilot basis beginning in 1995. So it was, there were certain counties that were in locations in the state that we began working through the Oregon Health Plan structure, which basically meant that the services that were provided, and mental health services are included in the overall list of covered services that drive the services that are provided in the health plan. And in the beginning, only 25% of Medicaid eligibles were covered under the health plan. The remaining 75% had their mental health services continued to be provided in the Medicaid program on a fee-for-service basis in the as they were provided before the health plan. In 1997, the legislature approved mental health to go statewide, and so at that point it ceased being a pilot and became part of the benefit package for people who were determined eligible for Medicaid. And by 1998, it was up to 100%. We did a phase-in from the 25% to the 100%. Because of, at that point, we were in the process of selecting providers, what we term mental health organizations, to manage the services for the mental health component of the plan. And under legislative direction, we considered contracts with counties or groups of counties first. And in fact, our contractors now, by and large, are either single county agencies or groups of counties. Of our 10 mental health organizations, all but three are county-based. And those, the seven that are county-based, have 90% of the enrollees in the health plan under contract with the state for their managed mental health care.
Now, let me ask you a question. So most of your contracts are with counties, but do the counties provide the service, or do they then contract with someone else to provide the service?
Mr. Chair, it depends. In some counties, the county directly provides the service. An example would be Clackamas County. In other counties, there are county subcontracts for various components of the health plan business.
Right.
So it's a combination.
So the counties that are providing the service, I assume, are reimbursed by the health plan for their services provided. Is that correct? Is the county the service provider that receives monies from the health plan for providing the service or not?
In with the mental health organizations, the only two counties that are, and we're handing out some information about the mental health organizations so you can see which counties are included in them. Almost all of them are groupings of counties. There's a statutory provision that would allow local governments to come together and form entities that are recognized legally. And in most cases, the mental health organizations are a consortium of counties that have come together.
So the consortium of counties, they contract with your office, correct?
Correct. That's correct.
Okay. And then do they provide the service, or do they then, I assume they either provide it or they subcontract it, or they might do both. Is that right? Or?
The contract with the state contract with the mental health organization is one of a management and administrative management of the benefit package. So they act as administrators and administrative entity on behalf of the services that are included in the mental health benefit.
Okay, so I'm trying to follow the cash here. So you have a contract with the county. The county serves mostly as an administrative function, is that, no, yes?
In the, Mr. Chair, in the capacity of the mental health organization, for example, on the list of that you were, that this is the Accountable Behavioral Health Alliance, which is the mental health organization, then has as part of its responsibility the Benton, Lincoln, Deschutes, Crook, and Jefferson counties.
Okay, so that's the service area.
And they have relationships with those counties. The money from the state, capitated payment from the state, goes to Accountable Behavioral Health Alliance, and then they in turn distribute that money out to the county.
Okay, so the money is flowing from the state to the Accountable Behavioral Health Alliance, that money then flows to the five counties that are part of the service group.
Mm-hmm.
Then what happens to the money?
Then the Mr. Chair, then the services are provided, and either, depending on the structure at the county level, either by the county or by subcontracts with private nonprofit mental health providers.
If Benton County, as an example, did all of the mental health services, then they would retain the resources within their county budget appropriated for that purpose. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
All right. And then Lincoln County may basically have contracts with local providers. The money then flows through the Lincoln County to those local providers.
Mm-hmm.
How does the fee for service and health maintenance organization thing fit in here?
The essence of the health plan's capitation or managed care component is that the state makes a payment based on some actuarial estimate of cost.
Okay, now hang on a very, is it a, because I'm simple-minded here, is it so much money per enrollee, or is it fee for service, or is it both?
Mr. Chair, the capitation payments are paid on a per member per month basis, and the rate depends on which eligibility category an individual is in. So it obviously costs more for a disabled person to receive health care or mental health care than somebody.
But the whole system is set up that way, the capitation system. So you got so much money per enrollee, but it's then either larger or smaller depending on what category they sit in. Correct?
No? Well, Mr. Chairman, the rates don't change according to how large the organization is, but that's one of the important issues, because if the counties were to receive these funds in with the same risk-bearing arrangements on a county-by-county basis, there are literally counties in Oregon that would not be large enough to manage the risk of even one patient going to the hospital. So what the counties in essence did in applying to the state under the RFP that we issued were to group themselves into, well, they're really Chapter 190 organizations. They're like councils of government, and those organizations bear the risk. In turn, the counties that provide services who have the staff, and the staff of the mental health organizations is generally quite small, the counties who deliver the services are not bearing risk in the same way. They may have an agreement to bear a certain amount of risk, but it's really the mental health organization that's accountable. And I should point out that two of the contracts we have, one with Clackamas and one with Lane County, these are single counties, Multnomah also, that have a contract with us. But the contract is a different kind of contract from the other mental health services that are provided to the county. These contracts are written in a very business-like, marketplace-oriented way. And our job is to make sure that the terms of the contract with respect to the services as well as finances are managed in the way that we agreed to.
All right. I'm still not sure that I understand.
It's complicated.
It is. And is it necessarily complicated?
Well, Mr. Chairman, one of the things that the Oregon Health Plan was to achieve, in addition to reducing uninsurance, was to provide more predictability and stability in our Medicaid system. And that is more true in mental health than any other part of the system. We have about nearly 90% of the people in Medicaid are in managed care. The costs in the provider system have been, there's been continuity. We haven't seen the plans dropping in and out and so forth. And in addition, more people have been served over time, and the rates have not gone up significantly. And in fact, in the current biennium, we actually reduced the rate a percent or two in the first year of the biennium. So costs are generally under control, as they were quite out of control earlier. So the marketplace model is actually working in mental health. It doesn't mean we don't have other problems. The prevalence of mental illness and the complexity of mental illness in this relationship with poverty and housing and all of the substance abuse. But generally, in terms of the administrative model, it seems to be working.
Help me understand the necessity. As a state, we have administrative costs for running the program, correct? The funds are various positions for that. And then the money flows to, in this first case, the Accountable Behavioral Health Alliance. I assume that they have administrative costs for doing what they do. And then the money goes from there to the county in that service authority, and then each of those counties have administrative costs. And then if they sub that work out, then that subcontractor has administrative costs. So has anybody ever looked at how much money actually gets to the patients, people that need it? How much is, and over time you're picking up a lot of the costs of the value of this money is diminished by the administrative expenses, I assume.
Yes, those questions can be, I can't tell you this morning, but the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, for example, looks at I've forgotten what the terms are, but the loss ratio, in effect, what percentage is spent on health care, what's spent on administration. In the general medical part, it varies widely from a low of about 5% up to, I think it's in the neighborhood of 20% administrative costs.
That may not be inherently bad. I'm just because I assume that if the state had all of the contract work and had all of the employees, we could minimize administrative costs, but the organization would be huge and it would be ours as opposed to locally controlled, et cetera. So
we should be able, Senator, to quantify that for you if you want, but I can't do it this morning. It is, I couldn't conclude whether those costs have increased as a result of this kind of business model.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a question that people raise from time to time. Doesn't it seem like there's too many layers?
Well, and for each layer, I mean, it wouldn't be unlike having, you know, a wholesaler and a distributor and a retailer, and the more people that the product, you know, goes through, I mean, they're recouping their costs, and eventually the price of the product has to be pretty small to absorb the administrative costs and transportation, et cetera, to eventually make a profit on the outside end. Not that we're making a profit, but hopefully profiting the people receiving the services. Okay. So do you think this is the best model for delivering mental health services, given the situation? Okay.
That is a... Mr. Chairman, that's a complicated question, because the goals of the health plan and the model used to finance mental health care has brought into service people who have never had access to mental health services before. And in that respect, it has opened doors that we have not, you know, been able to walk through in the past. On the other hand, we still have a target population that very often is homeless and continues to have difficulty getting into the system, and many of those people are not eligible for the Oregon.
So help me understand, too, how this works. We talked about Oregon Health Plan, where we're really kind of incorporating all of the categorical eligibles and the so-called new eligibles, but when we talk about mental health, do they fit into all of those categories, categorical eligibles, et cetera, et cetera? Now, if the state chose to rescind the entire health plan and just go back to the basic Medicaid package required by the federal government, mental health, I assume, would not be part of that. Is that accurate, or is this
Mr. Chair, no, mental health is part of the Oregon Health Plan.
So I understand it's part of the Oregon Health Plan, but if we went back to just the federal minimums for Medicaid, is mental health part of the federally mandated program?
No.
It is not. Okay. So when we talk about mental health, we're really talking about that part of the Oregon Health Plan that is in addition to whatever the federal minimum is for Medicaid. Yes, sir. Thanks, Senator. Barry, perhaps you can just maybe not elaborate because it's pretty complex, but just touch on some of the integrated model approach that Oregon is looking at in terms of acute health and mental health in terms of an integrated system. When we asked about what is the best model, is Oregon still pursuing integrating acute health and mental health?
Mr. Chairman, I do understand the direction moving. Before I go there, let me point out that pharmaceuticals, for example, are not a mandated service, and certainly one of the achievements of the 90s was the introduction of pharmaceuticals that really have a tremendously effective impact in both depression and psychosis. If those were not available, that would be a serious problem as well. Those are not a part of the mental health integration and capitation. Those pharmaceuticals are all paid on a fee-for-service basis. It's one of the reasons the cost has not been as well controlled as other parts of the mental health service.
Okay, so when we talk about the cost for running mental health from the organizations that you just outlined, the pharmaceutical reimbursement, that's separate.
So
we can set that aside. That's part of the $900 million that we talked about earlier. But that was one of my questions, was what percentage of or what portion of the $900 million first pharmaceutical medications are antipsychotic medications and medications used in mental health?
Mr. Chairman, about a quarter of the pharmaceutical expenditure is for psychotropic drugs.
So one quarter.
A little more if you include the anti-seizure medicines, which are now also fee-for-service. And I can't give you the distribution on depression, antidepressants versus antipsychotics. But
roughly.
We have a lot of data, and we can provide a pretty comprehensive report on it.
I'm just trying to get a thumbnail understanding of how this all
happens. About a quarter of $1 billion of biennium for mental health drugs.
All right, Senator Nevin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your inviting me in this morning to listen and learn from this hearing. I do have a very large concern, and maybe I should give you a little background for the benefit of the rest of your committee. I became aware of this early last spring that one county in my district, at least, had developed an ending balance of between $6.5 and $6.9 million. They had done that in 7 years. And so that from that point on, I've been learning a lot of how this system works and how it functions. I am confused, and if you could clarify this for me is one of my questions. I note in your response to your letter back to the fiscal office that the MHOs are required to retain $250,000 a piece as a residual. But I'm not clear to me whether the other contracting groups, such as counties, are also required to have at least a $250,000 reserve. Could you clarify that for me? Because,
Mr. Chair, Senator Messerly, the $250,000 reserve that you referenced is a requirement that is in our contract with each of the mental health organizations. And so we would expect the reserve at the level of the mental health organization, but that requirement does not filter down to the counties that are a part of that organization. We contract with the MHO. We expect the MHO to have the $250,000 in reserve.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Sure, go ahead.
In your opinion, is it prudent, is it necessary for the other contractors below the MHO to also carry a reserve then? And is there any optimum amount of which?
Mr. Chair, Senator Messerly, in our review of the quarterly financial statements that we've been receiving since 1999, in looking at the financial statements that are submitted by the MHOs, we realized that in order for the state to understand what was happening at the county level, we needed that information from the counties as well and began collecting it. So the counties do report their revenues and expenditures to us on a quarterly basis. And in our analysis of this, we look at from quarter to quarter what the cash flow, what the expenditure flow looks like. Taking a snapshot is not representative necessarily of how the organizations are doing, but over time you can see trends. And I think that our contractual relationship is with the MHO in Oregon Health Plan Services. So our requirement has only applied to the MHO. The MHO, in turn, then works with its sub-organizational unit to understand their fiscal position and watch to make sure that they are in a sustainable position. That's part of their job. That's part of why we pay them the administrative fee that we do.
I have another follow-up.
Sure. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. And I appreciate the correspondence and the communications I've had with Mr. Cast and his staff since we've been working on this and trying to get to the bottom of it. But there's several questions that really come to mind. I really do have a question, and maybe I need more history, but the appropriateness of the MHOs and what is their function at this time? And maybe should the state of Oregon be holding the reserve? And if there's organizations, whether it's at the county level or contractors that need to draw on reserves, would it be more appropriate if they came to the state? I'm not clear in my own mind the way the organization works, where we pay by the enrollees to the Oregon Health Plan as opposed to fee for service. And Mr. Chair, I know you started on this line earlier, and it seems to me that we have very little control over some of these reserves, and the bottom line is whether the citizens of Oregon are getting service, and I'm not sure we have a good handle on that. And so I guess two questions that I don't know if you can answer them today, but two questions that I would have are, again, number one, are the MHOs appropriate in today's atmosphere, in today's society? And number two is, would fee-for-service be more appropriate in making sure that the monies that the state allocates to mental health actually does get to the service of the citizens? Thank you.
Well, Senator, I think those are good questions. I'm still somewhat confused. In your area, I'm not sure which health maintenance, I've got to get the right words here, right? It's mental health organization, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Know what it is? So in your region, they have a $6 million, $6.9 million reserve.
Mr. Chair, that's inaccurate. The mental health organization, I think, I don't know how much they have. I think they've got a little over $1 million. That shows in the records here. But Coos County, only one of those six counties that are part of the MHO has the figures vary. At one point it was 6.9, and the latest I've seen is $6.5 million reserve.
So Coos County has $6 million reserve?
6.5.
For mental health?
Right.
So the Jefferson Behavioral Health Mental Health Organization, do they have a $250,000 reserve? So they have a $250,000, and then Coos County has $6 million. Curry County has something. Douglas County, Jackson.
Mr. Chair, what I've found is that some counties are running very short and have inadequate reserves, and yet there, I believe there's two counties in the state that have very large reserves.
So, okay, I mean, and I assume your interest is to get services to people who need them. Because I'm sitting here thinking, as a state budget chair, maffe can pull these monies back into the state coffers and spend them for something else. So that's not your interest, right?
Well, no, it's not. It is to give service, but as I understand the way the organization is set up, we can't do that if we wanted to.
Yeah, interesting. Okay. Gary, you want to respond? And then Senator Trump.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I can, I'd like to provide a little bit of history about this issue, because I think we're confusing different kinds of organizations and different kinds of accounting. For many years, in the 60s, when the mental health division was created, and then subsequently the Department of Human Services through the 1970s, the direction of the moving was to encourage counties to take responsibility for mental health services. And there was a matching requirement. If the counties would put up 50 cents, the state would put up 50 cents. And the way we worked the Medicaid budget in those days was that for every dollar that the county billed in fee-for-service Medicaid, the state would offset the match amount by reducing the general fund payment, the match payment. In 1981, the legislature directed us not to match the funds and not to offset the Medicaid payments, but they also required that the counties retain any revenues received, whether it was from general fund, federal funds, fee revenue, in their mental health programs, to retain them and spend them only on approved mental health services. Approved meaning, in this case, I think, under the rules that the division adopted. So basically, these mental health accounts that now exist in every county were created for the counties to account for that legislative requirement in 1981. Some counties, and we've looked at all of the counties, report nothing or very small amounts in those funds. Some counties report substantial amounts in those accounts. In any case, the county's report, the financial statements, are not the same revenues as the mental health organization reports that we are now and have been requiring since 1999. Those are reports solely limited to the funds paid under the Oregon Health Plan. So to tease out what, and I've talked with Coos County staff about this, so I pretty much know what's going on in Coos County, and I'll share that with you in a moment. On a statewide basis, tease out what source of funds the counties are reporting would take a considerable amount of work, which in this interim we haven't been able to do. But we can do that. Those mental health accounts include not just Oregon Health Plan payments to the MHOs, but also fee-for-service receipts the counties get directly, other sources of funds, whether from grants or fee revenue, and they retain them, and then our expectation is that they will spend them on approved services. And we haven't found an example yet of where a county took mental health funds and spent them on paving roads, for example, which was the concern I think the legislature had in 1981. All of that is background. What happened here, and I've got to tell you just as a matter of personal history, that we sat in this very room in 1993 when we decided to put mental health into the Oregon Health Plan. At that time, the Ways and Means Committee was split into House and Senate. Mr. Walden was the chair. And there was concern, and I expressed concern, that in bringing the health plan up to speed very rapidly, we would be pumping a lot of money into the mental health system for which there was no capacity to provide services. Those counties which came in early had to ramp up, hire staff, create systems, find occupancy facilities and so forth. And I talked with Coos County folks, and that is essentially the story that they will tell you, that they went from 20 to 60 employees over 5 years. They had to revamp their system. We've been in there a couple of times for site visits. There have been problems. But they seem to be mastering those problems. And I met with New Senator Messerly just a few weeks ago and then went over to look at the program. Their plan is to spend some of those dollars on a new building, which will provide them with the kind of facility that can run a modern mental health program. And incidentally, will also be located close to the other Department of Human Service site in Coos County over by the community college, the Newmark Center. So then I asked myself, well, if they were accumulating these funds, why weren't they spent in addition to not having enough staff? Well, until recently, the county wasn't charging rent for the building they're in. There are other legal fees and county expenses, which could have been expensed. So we have Coos County with its kind of accounting. And then you can go to another county and where all of those dollars are spent in some way. If the county has a different method of accounting for how it tracks funds. I guess what we've concluded as a result of this study is we need to bring greater consistency to these financial reports to define the ways in which the MHOs and the counties will report to us so that we can compare apples to apples, as the phrase goes, and understand fully what's going on. One of the things that we cannot do is go back to the counties under the current law and say, you've got $6 million in the bank, we'll take a check, please. We cannot do that. We are talking with the counties about rate adjustments that would prevent that kind of what would in effect an overpayment from occurring in the future. We're working with the actuaries and the MHOs on that. And all of that is contained in the report, I think, that we made to the well, we haven't made it yet. It's actually a report to the emergency board, which hasn't taken place yet.
Okay, let me get to Senator Trowan, and I'll get back to that.
My question is, were these reserves built up because patients went unserved?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trowan, I think conceivably one could conclude that people didn't receive all the services they needed. It may be that they couldn't deliver those services because the capacity wasn't there to do so. And we had no
on the basis of what we thought the service load would be, and then
exactly.
Somehow or other they ended up with reserves, and we think that some patients didn't get served.
Exactly. I'd say I want to point out in response in part to your question and also to Senator Messerly that this phenomenon is not limited to mental health services. I mean, the changes in healthcare generally have produced these kinds of distortions. And in fact, the kinds of accumulations of capital in other parts of the healthcare industry are equally variable. So that you've seen some fully capitated health plans prosper, and some have really struggled since the Oregon Health Plan came into effect. And I can't explain to you what...
Would it be true that those that have prospered are the ones that have not served their patients, and the ones that are in trouble are really trying to serve everybody? Is that the case?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I couldn't conclude that, no.
Okay. Well, why couldn't you conclude that? Or yes, I mean, that it is or is not.
Well, there are a couple of things to point out, Mr. Chairman. And one is that you have been, not you personally, but the legislature has been asking us to run on a more business-like basis. And the Oregon Health Plan was an effort to manage more consistently and in a marketplace. And the model that the legislature chose is a risk-based model. So risk varies. In a rural area, for example, where the staffing is very low and there is it's unpredictable from year to year how many people, for example, go to the hospital. The risk management may be very high. In some places, when you have a larger population, those costs can be predicted over time. I would say that for the first time, places in the state that had almost no resources for many years have the adequate resources to actually deliver a competent mental health program. And whether they were able to deliver all the services that people wanted, expected, or felt they were entitled to, that's a matter for debate.
Well, where's this risk-based model codified in statute? This risk-based model that you say the legislature chose, where is that codified in statute?
You know, I didn't.
Well, you said that the legislature chose a risk-based model for the funding mechanisms here, and I don't know where that's codified in statute, because statute's really the only expression of what the legislature chose or didn't.
Mr. Chair, and I think it's ORS 414, the authorizing, for the health plan, and it describes the process and the requirements for the actuarial rate-setting process, and it mentions that there needs to be a rate-setting process that recognizes the cost, the actual cost to providers, and that same language applies to the mental health rate-setting process. So it attempts to discover what the actual cost is to provide the service and then what the utilization rate would be over the various population groups that are covered by the health plan.
But I'm saying this to say that it's probably more likely than not true that from that statute, if that's the right citation, that it's been extrapolated out that through administrative rules, that this is the way the system functions. So I'm saying all of that to say that, in my opinion, we need to spend more time looking at this and working on it, because I am not satisfied at all that we're doing a good job as a state in terms of setting up, for instance, accounting practices to counties. Why do we have 36 counties who perhaps have 36 different ways of accounting for their resources? Now, it only really affects us to the degree that the state is providing a portion of those monies. The federal government seems to be very good at having a carrot stick mentality. We'll give you the money if, and we're not so good at that as a state. We want to have good relationships with our counties, but at the same time, we don't want to just simply give money because it's a good thing and then never follow up and find out whether or not we're actually receiving what we think we're receiving. I personally don't know the factual circumstances, but I know in Multnomah County, I've had employees of the mental health system tell me that there are monies that were missing in that organization when the previous director left, and there were accounting problems, there were concerns about where the money went, and it was clear that there was sloppy accounting. This was information that I get. Well, again, that points to the fact that we don't have systems in place that control how these resources are being used very well.
Mr. Chairman, I want to apologize if I sounded like I was blaming the legislature for something. We have tried to bring our what we're doing to you for your review. And, in fact, the whole concept of capitation is a risk-based concept, and I think the term in the law is managed care. And in the general medical part of the plan that you heard about last week, where about 72% of the enrollees, 73% are in fully capitated plans, the legislative direction has been to increase that to make your costs more predictable.
Right. And let me go back to 1993, if I recall correctly. We were in a historical period where we were deinstitutionalizing mental health patients, and the concept was we were going to have community-based treatment programs. And if I hear the Coos County situation, and at least it was a little red flag that went up, there's a $6.9 million reserve, and one of the thoughts they have about spending it is to build a building. And my immediate paranoid personality said, well, are they building another institution? Or in other words, we have smaller institutions in counties now as opposed to community-based mental health treatment programs as opposed to a larger statewide facility. I don't know.
In Mr. Chairman, in Coos County in particular, their use of the state hospital, which is for the purposes of this conversation what I think of as an institution, has declined, and they use Bay Area Hospital, I think that's the full name, Bay Area Hospital, for their psychiatric care. The building that they're talking about will replace their existing administrative and outpatient settings and also integrate their day programming in a new facility. And I went to visit the facility, and it is actually, they're currently in what was the old hospital many, many years ago. And staff are in closets and hallways, and they need a new building. It's there's a lot of problems with the building they're in.
But it does raise a question.
But it's not an institution. It's really an it's like a medical office or a health office.
It does not raise a question in terms of fiscal accountability that you would use resources originally provided for service to build a building or capital expenditure. Because, you know, generally when we build a building in state government, we use revenue bonds, and there's some revenue streams that we're using, or you know, they have general obligation bonds pledged against the general, you know, good faith and credit of the state. But generally, we don't use operational monies or monies intended, please pronounce those things, for building buildings.
I just want to, you know, make sure that there isn't a sense that funds have been redirected from patient care. You can't deliver patient care.
How would you know?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not here to defend Coos County. We can take a look at Coos County any way.
I'm not just focusing on Coos County. I'm just saying, how would you, as the director of this organization, know that those monies have not been diverted or held in advance or built into an ending balance so that they can build a building as opposed to provide services to the county? How would you know?
Well, we have the data that we have to look at, and Margie can enumerate all of those measures of performance and outcome, but we're interested in health status. We're interested in how many encounters occur. We want to know what kinds of services people are receiving, and things like the civil commitment rate, the utilization of state hospital beds, and those kinds of things. In general, those indicators are moving in the right direction, and in Coos County in particular, that they've done a good job of turning that system around since the early 90s. But you can't deliver a competent health service in a compromised setting, and most of us would not go to a doctor's office that looked like what many of our mental health programs looked like 4, 5, 6 years ago. In this intervening period, we've seen a general upgrading of the mental health system that had not occurred before, because all we were doing was the very basic services for the only most severely ill, and the health plan opened the door to a more comprehensive, integrated view, which Mr. Kobian was alluding to earlier.
Okay. Anyone else have any questions?
Mr.
Chairman.
Senator Farrelly. The county has operated a mental health program and accrued a surplus. And the questions were asked, how is it that you've accrued a surplus? And the answer is, well, we're not charging anything for rent. We're not charging any of the overheads. We're absorbing all that. And the agency said, well, you could expense that off. Wouldn't that have the effect of transferring mental health funds to the general fund of the county? Wouldn't that make those dollars fungible at that point? If they were then charging for rent, charging for overhead that had not previously been charged?
Chairman, Senator Farrelly, I think that the county would have the option, for example, of renting space on the private marketplace.
Yeah.
And then you would see those costs reflected in payments to an entity that provided that space. If the county do so, they have made an investment in that capital. And my point earlier was that if the county had expensed those occupancy costs and put them into a sinking fund for capital, then the issue wouldn't be coming before us today. It's each form of accounting, and I think this is a valid issue, because how is it that the cost that allocated, whatever the costs are, whether they're accounting costs or legal costs or occupancy costs, appropriately, and we expect our contractors to follow the federal guidelines on this, and there's a whole set of rules about that which we can discuss with you, but we would know if they were inappropriately being used for other purposes.
Mr. Chairman, I'll follow up.
Yes.
Many of the members on this committee also serve in education and revenue, and over the last 5 or 6 years, the recession has been gone to standardize accounting for schools and ESD for the same reason, that it's impossible for us to track 336 separate accounting systems at the county level. And there may not be 36, there's probably half a dozen models of one kind and a dozen of another. And then the rest are structured in the way that works best for the local CPA, because they built the county's model, computer model. But perhaps the lessons that we've learned in education and standardizing the county system is something that we need to do with all the divisions here. And I'm wondering if we haven't stumbled onto the issue that all the mental health allocations are accounted for through the courts and county systems, and so it must also be true that all of the other service delivery sectors underneath Health and Human Services, the Department of Human Services, must be having the same difficulty in tracking their expenditures. And I'm just wondering if there isn't an indicator that we need some kind of a standardized accounting system when state dollars go into the Oregon Health Plan or the Health and Human Services sector, so that we can compare apples and apples, even if we're not looking at the same kinds of candidates.
We should have a discussion with the counties to see what they think about that.
Yeah.
Senator
Bessel. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do want to clarify, in Coos County's case, and I'm not trying to beat up on my hometown county, believe me, but I think it does point to the fact that we do need, and the department's been very willing, very open with the fiscal office in trying to develop a better procedure to be more accountable. But Coos County has set aside, like I say, between $6.5 and $7 million, $6.9 million in 7 years. That's almost $1 million a year. That is more than just the rent on the facilities, and they have paid rent the last few years. I don't know how far back that goes, but there are other factors that they have indicated to me, such as they had trouble finding staff, and part of the reason for that is that they could have increased the compensation, but it was a unionized position in the county, and so that made it difficult for them to change the schedule. And so there's been those kinds of problems. The point I wanted to make was that it is more than just the rental, the lack of a rental fee by the county. And I guess one of the, just to summarize my concerns, is that I do think that out of this process that we do help the department define a better way of being accountable, not only for mental health, but all of our health issues. And something that's very troubling to me is that the system we presently have, where we basically have a MHO, an HMO for mental health, we are simply incentivizing a public body to not give service. At least that's the way I see it. And I would like to think I was wrong, but that's where it comes back to me. And I would hope that we could take, in this coming legislative session, take a really hard look at that.
All right.
Sure. I would ask Senator Messel if he understands what's happening in the mental health community out there. There are patients who believe they're not being served, and that as this money goes into some kind of a reserve account that you know of patients that are not being served with adequacy.
I am getting a lot of correspondence of organizations who are advocates for mental health patients who feel they are not being properly served, yes.
Senator Ferriero.
I just have to support the chairman on this issue of how would you know? If you don't have a standard accounting system, if you've got anomalies that are indicators, you know, 6 or 7 million piles up at a county. I'm not certain that isn't the right thing for these counties to do. I'm not certain that all the circumstances that you described are absolutely justifiable in their condition, in their circumstances. Certainly, they're subject to the same scrutiny on the systems as any other entity, public entity. But I think the counties put a point on it. So if there's no system inside the agency from comparison between counties, to show that what we intended is what happens, and how would we?
And I would assume it costs us more money if you've got 36 different counties doing accounting 36 different ways, and as the director, you want to find out what's going on in County 1 or County 5 or County 7, you've got to have somebody that's familiar with their accounting system that can decipher what does this all mean. Have you had any discussions with the counties about a standardized accounting system or reporting system that hasn't even been approached.
Mr. Chairman, I have not had those discussions for a long time. We've been using the terms of a federal circular that require impose a basic reporting model on all of us for federal funds as a standard for the industry, and I think I don't want to go into that in any detail.
We can say that for another time. Actually, I'd like to have some kind of a presentation on what the federal requirements are. If that's what we're relying on, it may be a good idea for us to have some briefing with respect to what those expectations are and whether they meet our expectations as a state. But clearly, if you've got federal requirements and the 36 counties are still reporting them differently, it's not necessarily maybe their codes or categories that are the problem, but rather maybe the methodologies that are there.
I just want to be clear that we do a lot of business with county governments. It's never been in our enabling legislation to impose upon the counties a method of accounting for their entire financial reporting structure. I think what we do now is expect a generally acceptable accounting principles and an annual audited statement, and that's what we work from.
But and I agree with what you're saying, except it's clear that we have different accounting systems, notwithstanding the general accounting principles. We still have different ways that things are reported. I think for the purpose of helping, you know, dumb legislators figure out what's going on, it'd be nice to have everything kind of organized in a logical and sequential way, because we always start at the lowest common denominator. We have to come in here and we waste your time having you re-explain things over and over and over again. So, Senator Trout.
It seems to me that somehow or other maybe we need to know more about what's going on, whether we need more monitoring or whether we need something in the contract. See, we contract with each of these provider organizations, don't we?
Yes, we do.
We have contracts. Do we contract or do the counties contract? The state contracts directly with the Accountable Behavior Health Alliance, or are we dealing with the counties who are in the alliance?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Crowe, the state contracts directly with the mental health organizations.
Okay, well,
and they in turn contract with county.
Our contracts allow us a monitoring role?
Oh, yes.
Okay. So we are checking them, and we're seeing to it that somehow or other they're serving the patient with our dollars, and they're not just accumulating a reserve for other purposes.
Absolutely.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Crowe, that we get on a quarterly basis and an annual basis, a number of reports that allow us to look at not only their revenues and expenditures, but also their levels of service. So we know how many clients each one of them is seeing every month. We have staff who follow up on that to assure that if there's something
that they're seeing all the clients, how many is one thing, all of them is another thing. Do we know that really qualify or need to be seen?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Schroeder, you know, to say that there's disagreement about who needs what level of service. There is a grievance process, and there's a mediating process that allows us to intervene when there is a legitimate concern about access to services. And there is variation across the counties in terms of access to services. We wouldn't expect that kind of lockstep uniformity, but
probably
if we
want a high level of good performance.
When we see it, yes. When we see outliers, we go out.
You have the ability to step in, and if you're not seeing it, to demand it, right?
Definitely.
Yes, we do.
How would you do that? How would you step in and demand it?
We, Mr. Chairman, we are actually engaged right now in a couple of site visiting processes that allow us to get direct access to the staff, to the advocates in the community, the advisory boards, for the clients themselves to investigate what kinds of services, the adequacy of services, and if we find problems, we can set expectations under the rules and under the contract, give them timelines for meeting those expectations. And in fact, we went through that very process with Spruce County just a year ago. And in response to that process, they've really made some dramatically positive changes in their system. So we do have mechanisms for that.
Let me kind of move on a little bit. I know that we've focused a lot on accounting systems and where's the money and where's the money going, et cetera, but the mental health system is much larger than all of that. Do you have more that you wanted to present in terms of the backdrop, or you wanted to just kind of move in the question? One of the questions, for instance, that I'm interested in, you may be covering this, is the number of providers available in the local communities and what the status of it is. I remember when we were transitioning from the state institution to so-called community-based models, there was a concern that we wouldn't have or may not have enough residential facilities available, or what's the status of all of that? Are there enough providers to meet the needs? Anybody?
Mr. Chair, from my memory, which I think I remember what your, one of the discussions about the concern around moving mental health into the health plan would be the availability of a provider community, that was ready to serve the patients. I think Barry mentioned that a little earlier. And in fact, in most areas of the state, that has been growing on a sustained basis. There are issues in the more rural areas of the state about access to certain levels of mental health professionals, but by and large, the whole provider community has grown and adapted with the emphasis on outpatient and more early intervention in terms of treatment of folks with mental health issues.
Right. And Barry, do you remember the discussions we had about some of the individuals that were living in, say, Danvers State Hospital at the time? Recall, where are they going to live? What are they going to do? I think there were some assumptions from the law enforcement community that a lot of these folks became what we called EDPs, emotionally disturbed persons, who basically were homeless individuals who had mental health issues but no place to live. Have you tracked any of those populations at all to find out whether or not they have a warm place to sleep? I guess housing is maybe the better.
Mr. Chairman, it's a complex issue, but let me try to simply tell you what we did and how we monitor that. And then if you need more information, we can make that available. As we were changing the size of the state hospitals, there were really two dimensions that needed change. One was we needed to take acute patients who were coming to the state hospitals, which are long-term institutions and by and large under-resourced for that purpose, and get those patients into better acute care hospitals, whether it's in Portland or Medford or Eugene or wherever in the state those folks are. The second population was these very long-term patients whose needs were met in the state hospital but who didn't need to be in that costly environment. We could live in residential settings in the community. And as we changed the hospitals, we took money out of that budget and moved it to community settings and built group homes and funded the services for them. That did not resolve the problem of a growing state population with a predictable incidence of mental illness or the needs of homeless people whose plight has gotten worse because the affordability of housing has gotten worse, or people who were both mentally ill and had substance abuse problems, addiction to drugs or alcohol, who in effect had a double stigma and who needed a special kind of service. And those are the problems we've been dealing with and which have led to the issue that you and I have been working on for a couple of years with respect to people who make their way into correctional settings or local jail because they don't they can't get access to the kinds of services they need. And we're moving to respond to that in partnership with the county. It's not essentially a health plan issue, but it is it's a major issue for the mental health system. And if we don't do something about it, we'll have to start rebuilding state hospitals, and that would be much more expensive than dealing with it at the community. Now, I don't know if that is the kind of question you were asking.
I think it does. I mean, mental health is one of the areas that becomes more obscure, I think, in public policy making. Generally, it's a topic that most policymakers don't want to spend a lot of time with. And from my experience, you start talking about mental health, and it's like, yeah, well, let's talk about something a little sexier. Let's talk about criminal justice and putting somebody in prison. Those things are, as far as politicians, get you a lot farther to talk about throwing somebody in prison than to talk about the issues of the mentally ill. But they're huge public policy questions, and to some extent it relates to the question Senator Meserly was chatting about mental health service in the local community. And I don't know that this is connected, but I know they've had a number of high-profile homicides there recently that appeared to be, you know, odd situations. I don't know if the mental health histories of those individuals would indicate that they were not getting services, but I know that from my experience in law enforcement, we're seeing more and more traumatic, violent encounters between law enforcement and individuals with mental health problems. So it's not that we didn't have them before when we had damage, but it seems that those instances have increased with this whole idea that you deinstitutionalize and go to community-based programs. And it makes me wonder whether or not the level of services are, in fact, adequate for those people. And my sense is they're not, but that, you know, it's an area that we really need to spend some more time as a state talking about public policy and how do we facilitate that discussion in our counties and service providers.
Mr. Chairman, the governor appointed a work group on the adequacy of the mental health system, which worked during the last interim, and issued a pretty comprehensive report. And I think it would be fair just to cite the gap that they identified, which was in terms of the, I don't remember the numbers of dollars, but it was in the tens of millions of dollars in services that were needed to get control of the problems that you're talking about. If you look at the budget for mental health services, leaving aside the health plan for a moment, which is a different kind of service and expanded to a new population, the state, not just Oregon, but all across the country, for adults, the effort in mental health in real dollars has declined. And it's declined as the state hospital has gone down. And from a policy perspective, it should have been the other way around. As the hospitals were going down, that effort should have increased. And we can only speculate on why that happened. A lot of it happened because of fiscal constraints on the state, but other issues have to do with we own the state hospital, but the community is over there. And if it weren't for the counties, and I used to work for Benton County, who knows what kind of a mental health system we have. We're grateful that they're there and engaged and focusing on these issues, but they do it on a shoestring, and that's pretty much the problem.
And just with regard to this list of mental health organizations that are contracted with the state, are you generally pleased that this group of contractors are doing a good job with the state? As you monitor them and see the operation as they deal with various counties, some have the Gobi group, for instance, has looks like it must have 10 or 12 counties. So forth. But I don't mean to pick that one out, but you got all of these groups. So how are they doing collectively? Should we be satisfied with them that we're getting a good bang for our buck in terms of serving people?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cho, we're never satisfied.
Okay, well.
We're always grouchy. But in general, we're pretty pleased with the performance of these organizations, both in terms of increasing access to services and also that they stuck with us. We cut their rates a year ago.
Are they pleased with you? Do they think that they're being adequately funded to do the job?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cho, we have an ongoing process, a monthly interaction between state administration and the leadership of these organizations, and they're continuing to work on problems. I haven't heard that they're not happy with us, but I'm sure they are grouchy too sometimes. We're talking about a business relationship which...
Do others of these contractors have very large reserves that they need to explain why they exist?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cho, we've provided you and the Legislative Fiscal Office with a report explaining what those net worth values are, and they're highly variable. There are several organizations that have more than 3 months of working capital, and most of them do not. Most of them do not. And my concern would be that we find a way to solve the problem of a great, more consistent delivery of services.
I presume that you really want them to have some reserve. Saying you should go want them to have an excessive amount of reserve, right?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, like any effective and accountable business, yes, they must have a reserve that can sustain them and pay their bills.
If the reserves become excessive, you have the ability to look into it and explore it and find out why.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Crowe, if yes, we do have that ability, and it raises questions that we tried to address in the report that we is soon to be before you. It raises issues about rates, it raises issues about accounting practices, and we intend to address all of those. And the recommendation of the legislative fiscal office is that we bring back reports from time to time during the next session about the progress.
All right. Thank you very much. Any other questions or whatnot? I appreciate your presentation. And I would encourage any of the members of the Senate, the friends of the House, to spend some time, at least locally and with this office, to understand a little bit better how it functions so that we can, I think as we look at it, try to improve the process. And at least my inquiries are not hostile inquiries. I'd like to see the system function better. As a state legislator, I'd like to be able to find out the truth of the matter, rather than having to hunt for it. We're going to transition now to talking about the DHR.
Can I make one comment? I want to, lest there be any misunderstanding, we appreciate Senator Messerly bringing this to our attention in the way that he did and sticking with it and pushing us to get clearer about this issue. This is not a trivial issue. This is a substantial one. And I think the result of this inquiry will be a better functioning administration, and maybe we'll see improvements in the whole system. But we haven't been ignoring this, and I want the record to show that we're grateful to him for doing so.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that, Mr. Kass. Thank you for your time. And we have Ms. Reed back to come and talk to us about the organizational structure and who the power brokers are in DHR to make the decision.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lynn Reed, Assistant Administrator with the Office of Medical Assistance Programs within the Department of Human Services. As I understood, your request for today was to talk a little bit about Medicaid and the Oregon Health Plan within the Department of Human Services, how policies are made, and then carrying that on through the administrative rules process. And I was going to focus particularly in what I talk about today about the Office of Medical Assistance Programs component of that, but I want to set the context in terms of Medicaid running throughout the department and know that you have an interest in various aspects of it. With that, two items are being handed out, and they go along with a document you already have from your staff, which is the department's organizational chart, which is printed off of the department's webpage. In general, Medicaid and Oregon Health Plan responsibilities are throughout the department and outside of the department. And before I talk about it within the department, I would just like to point out this one document that I've handed out, which talks about the Oregon Health Plan and the fact that Medicaid exists outside of the Oregon Health Plan. For example, long-term care is outside of the health plan, the mental health institutions, residential chemical dependency, the home and community-based care, and then there are certain Medicaid components administered by OMAP, but they're not part of the health plan. In the middle are the pieces that are within Oregon Health Plan Medicaid, physical health, the mental health services administered by the MHOs, chemical dependency services, outpatient type services for health plan eligible dental care. And then to the far right, there are components of the Oregon Health Plan that currently are outside of Medicaid. The Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, the work that's done by the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research, Dr. Stanna's office, services provided through the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, the high-risk pool for Oregon, and the Insurance Pool Governing Board. As Dr. Santa mentioned the other day, the healthcare marketplace out there isn't driven by the Oregon Health Plan. We're impacted directly by it and respond in many cases to the issues that surface in that arena, such as advances in technology, new drugs, things that can drive up healthcare costs and better outcomes. And then those are things that impact our program as well. But to talk about Medicaid within the Department of Human Services, we're organized into several kind of clusters within the department. In the health services cluster, which is the administrator, Barry Cass, OMAP is part of that cluster, and I will come back to talk more about OMAP. The Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, which was the focus of this earlier presentation, has a responsibility for Oregon Health Plan mental health, chemical dependency services, and some other Medicaid services. The Office of Family Health Services, a part of the public health part of our section, handles the Medicaid Family Planning Waiver, handles the immunization registry for the state, which has some Medicaid dollars coming into it. Seniors and People with Disabilities section handles long-term care, the skilled nursing facilities, the assisted living facilities, group homes, in-home services. Also programs for persons with developmental disabilities, the Medically Fragile Children's Program. They handle eligibility policy for those programs. And by virtue of someone by virtue of qualifying for one of those programs generally will qualify for Medicaid and Oregon Health Plan coverage and services. They also handle eligibility for a program called Medically Needy, which allows some persons with higher incomes with significant medical needs to qualify for Medicaid, for a very limited Medicaid benefit package. They also handle eligibility for qualified Medicare beneficiaries and specified low-income Medicare beneficiaries. These are federal programs that require Medicaid services, limited benefit be available, and they handle the eligibility for those programs. The Children, Adults, and Families section, Jim Neely is the deputy in that section, and he talked the last few days about the some of the issues of eligibility policy and eligibility determination. They handle eligibility for the TANF program, the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, for emergency assistance for non-citizens, the Poverty Level Medical Program for pregnant women and children, the eligibility for those new eligibles under the Oregon Health Plan who would not qualify except for the waivers that we currently have. They will handle the eligibility policy for the expansion eligibles under OHP2. They handle eligibility for the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP. And then for the protective eligibility for children in protective services, foster care, subsidized adoption. People who qualify for those programs, once again, for things like TANF or foster care, become eligible for Medicaid in the Oregon Health Plan by virtue of qualifying for this other program. And of course, children, adults, and families have many other policy responsibilities that relate to operating those programs. Then there's the Community Human Services cluster, and this is essentially the field structure for the department. They determine eligibility. Vicki Green was here talking about the portion that the centralized branch handles, but Community Human Services has offices throughout the state in communities, and that's where you're seeing some of the most interesting changes as the department reconfigures itself and looks at meeting the needs of individuals at one stop. And it's out there where eligibility is actually determined according to the rules set by these other parts of the department, where clients are enrolled in managed care plans in order to access their organ health plan benefits, and where case management services are provided. The department also has a section of administrative services, and in there you'll see some Medicaid components related to the accounting of dollars, the federal reporting that's required. Our information systems are run through that centralized office. There's also a finance and policy analysis office, which Doug Wilson formerly managed, and now George Stanford. That's where the budget function takes place for the department, including the Oregon Health Plan, and where rate-setting activities are administered. And then within the director's office itself, I know one of your particular interests has been on auditing. The department's audit unit is in the director's office, and there you have both internal audits and provider audits focused there, which is, at one point in time, the provider audits were located within OMAP, and now they're further removed, which allows for a more third-party look, although it is still within the department in terms of looking at providers. To focus on OMAP more specifically, and I did provide you with a document that comes out of our federal state plan that just shows in a broad sweep the OMAP structure. We have policy responsibility for acute care medical services under Medicaid, both those that are Oregon Health Plan Medicaid services and for the non-organ health plan component of the Medicaid program, and for the Children's Health Insurance Program. That means we're responsible for policy related to things like physician services, hospital services, prescription drugs, dental services, and other medical professional services. We're responsible for policies relating to the delivery system for those services, the managed care plans, and fee-for-service. And then we're also responsible for policies related to the payment for those services. Our process for setting policy, and this applies, although I'm specifically talking about OMAP, applies very broadly, I think, within the department. Policy direction comes from many places. It comes from enacted bills by the legislature. It comes from budget decisions, including rebalances of our budget in the e-board. It comes from the federal government, regulations, new laws. It comes from our waiver terms and conditions. All of these things are outside influences which direct what kinds of policies we move forward. In addition, policies are created in a collaborative process within the department, because as you could see from just looking at the departmental organization, Medicaid policy, Oregon Health Plan has its tendrils throughout the department. We have a Medicaid policy committee that specifically looks at, addresses issues of policy. There are other state agencies and boards which we collaborate with and which have input into establishing policies we want to move forward. The Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research, John Santa's office, which looks at broad-based policy for the state. The Insurance Pool Governing Board and the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program administered by it. The Oregon Medical Insurance Pool with its high-risk pool. The Oregon Youth Authority. I don't know if you're aware or not, but Medicaid services and the Oregon Health Plan services are available to many of the Oregon Youth Authority clients. The Medicaid Fraud Unit, which is part of the Department of Justice. Through their work, we get input that directs us to move in different policy directions in order to address issues that they've raised. Similarly, Secretary of State Audit Division, we move forward policies as a result of information that comes out of those audits. We have a wide assortment of advisory committees. Some are required by the federal government, some are required by state statute, and some of them just make good sense in terms of involving all the right people in a direction for state policy. There's a Medicaid advisory committee required by federal and state statutes. There's an Oregon Drug Review Board, also required both by federal and state statutes.
Okay, Lynn, you're driving me crazy. We need to make a board game out of this. Trying to figure out who's on first here. And you're doing a great job. Don't take my remarks negatively. I'm just kind of zoom up here. But who does the legal work? I don't see legal here anywhere. I mean, the Attorney General, I assume, does. But when you have legal issues, as I assume you would on a regular basis, who handles that?
Mr. Chair, depending on what those issues are, generally our first contact would be with General Counsel Linda Grimm in the Department of Justice.
Linda who?
Grimm, G-R-I-M-M-S, would be our first contact.
Okay.
In terms of knowing what it is we're required to do, if we need some interpretation, whether or not something we want to do is appropriate.
Right. And you from time to time have their, well, I'm maybe transitioning into other, do you have legal issues associated with OMAP and the health plan? Does that group get sued on regular basis like some other groups?
Mr. Chair, to date, our Attorney General budget pot has been somewhat small compared to some other parts of the department. But there are times when suits are filed. We are represented by the Department of Justice, and then depending upon what the issue is, it probably wouldn't be with General Counsel. It will probably go to a Trials Division or some other part of DOJ.
You know, I'd like to maybe at some point have you back and maybe have Bobby Mink come in and tell us. I'd like to know a little bit more about how decision-making works in the organization. Because I'm looking at this thing, I'm thinking, if I was Bobby Mink, being the director of the Department of Human Resources, this is a huge responsibility. And this is almost overwhelming, and I wonder about the capacity of one individual to do this. But I'm just very interested in how policy changes are accomplished, and how do you all get together and talk about what you're going to do from day to day? You have staff meetings, you talk about the Oregon Health Plan and who's generally present at these meetings, things like that. But in other words, who are the key decision makers that show up at your meetings? Now, I'm noticing that Gary is really at the top of the heap here. Is that accurate?
That's correct.
The organizational chart.
Gary is as it relates to the health services cluster of the department.
Which includes the Oregon Health Plan.
And it includes the Oregon Health Plan.
So he's really the guy responsible for all of this, ultimately. Is that right?
That's correct. And
so when we beat up on Hirsch Crawford, we're really beating up on the wrong guy. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. If you want the bus to stop here, Gary will do
it. And it's a real key. If you're gonna change public policy or understand public policy, you gotta know who you're talking to. You gotta know if you're talking to the person that can make the decision for it or not. But Gary's the guy.
That's correct.
Unless you get hired in the next.
And we do have a sign-off process in terms of the administrative rule process that does go through there, and so that Barry is aware and on board with, for example, administrative rule changes.
Well, and I think what I'd like to know, too, a little bit more about how much latitude do managers have to make decisions within the organization? I work in a police department, and by and large, our managers have virtually no latitude to make independent decisions for the most part. They do, but, you know, generally it's all structured based on a manual of rules and procedures and so on and so forth, and all of their decision-making generally has to follow in that guideline. But I want to know a little bit more about how the decision-making and policy-making occurs here. And more to Barry, I just put you on the spot and put a big target on your back saying you're really the guy we should be focusing on when we talk about the Oregon Health Plan. So hopefully you've blown up on it. You don't have to come up. I'm just anyway, and then eventually I want to get into some discussion about our relationship with the federal government on health policy and where we think we're going there. Is that hopefully not too vague? It's like I feel like I'm swimming in an ocean. It's either the Atlantic or the Pacific from one moment to the next. But my assumption is if we don't start getting a handle on this, we're going to be fucking wind. Senator Crowe?
My question was a very specific one. Who in the organization does the contracting with the HMOs? Who does that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Crowe. The HMOs, or fully capitated health plans, as we call them, are those contracts are done in OMAP. And so we sign those contracts. In fact, usually I sign them.
Are they, for the providers dealing with the counties, are they pretty much uniform contracts from provider to provider, or are they substantially different, with different terms and different amounts of compensation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, for the MHOs, they're uniform contracts. The minor changes related to what county someone might cover, what their capacity is, how many folks they can handle.
Based on actuarial studies?
Mr. Chair, Senator Crow, yes, that's correct. And in fact, I've asked someone to bring over copies of the two reports that I mentioned the other day that are actuarial reports that will give you more detailed information about the rate setting process. Generally speaking, I know Barry and Margie talked this morning about MHOs, mental health organizations in the county. And the MHOs deal a lot with counties as their delivery system and contractors. It's a little different for the HMOs.
I noticed that we're being sued by Deschutes County for inadequacy of funding. Is that something different than the contract we negotiated with them?
Mr. Chair, Senator Crow, have not yet reviewed the complaint from the Central Oregon COIHS plan, but indeed that is a suit that relates to our contract with them, and that is over with the Department of Justice right now for review.
Is that contract about to expire, supposed to be renegotiated?
Yes, all of the contracts come due at the end of September, and so we have new contracts out for signature right now for October 1.
Have you not lived up to your end of the contract? Is that why you're suing you?
Mr. Chair, Senator Crow, I really can't comment on that suit while it's at this point in time.
I need to know more about it.
All right. Well, I think we're going to recess now at the call of the chair. We've got some political stuff going on in the building here, and I think all of us want to get lunch and get our bearings and find out what's going on with the so-called negotiations regarding this fifth special session. I want to thank everyone who's presented so far for their tolerance and their willingness to answer all of these questions, and appreciate it.
May I make a statement, please? I was distracted a moment. I think that Senator Scholl was asking some questions about various lawsuits, and I just want to declare a conflict because I am on a board, the board, for Central Oregon Independent Health System. Thank you.
Other than that, it was a pleasure. All right. Thank you very much. We'll be in the show.